You're listening to 9 Plus, a research podcast from SETU Ireland. Hello and welcome to 9 Plus, a podcast in which we discuss some of the research being conducted by staff and students at the South East Technological University of Ireland. My name is Rob O'Connor and I'm a lecturer from the Department of Computing and Mathematics, but we discuss all disciplines here. And today we're talking about ethics in the music industry. I loved recording this episode in which I spoke with SETU music lecturer and researcher Mark Graham. Mark is a great man to talk and he's just starting his PhD journey currently titled Moving Towards Ethical and Sustainable Music Industry Practice. This draws on Mark's extensive experience as both an academic and a musician. Mark has been performing with the band King Kong Company for probably more years than he'd like to admit, whilst also working as a music lecturer in SETU, formerly WIT. If you'd like to get some context into where Mark is coming from musically, I thoroughly recommend watching some videos of King Kong Company performances and checking out their back catalogue. He turned the tables on me a number of times during the interview, as I have my own experience in the music industry, both as a musician and a DJ. He's looking at some of the practices that are acceptable in the music industry that would seem strange anywhere else. Mark and I had a good ding-dong about it, and I'm very excited to follow his work. During the podcast, it may seem like I'm arguing with Mark, but I'm just adopting a devil's advocate role to stimulate debate. As always, I began the conversation by asking Mark to introduce himself.
My name is Mark Graham and I'm a lecturer in the Department of Arts, specialising in music technology and music industry practice.
Okay, now as well as an academic career, you also have a fairly extensive career as an artist in mostly in the musical genre, okay? But I would say there's a fair element of theatre in it. So probably most well-known for your work with King Kong Company, the MVPs on the Irish festival circuit for many, many years. And the reason I say theatre elements to it is that one of the things that I think differentiated King Kong Company from other dance music bands was the element of the show. It was very theatrical in what you produced. Dancers, costumes, schemes and things like that. Could you maybe just describe what you were doing there? And let's assume somebody never saw King Kong Company or never heard King Kong Company. What was King Kong Company? What was your role in King Kong Company, I should say?
I'd kind of go back to how I was brought up. Like I come from a background in musical theatre. My family would be steeped in that. My sister's involved in it. My father, there was a thing called the Tops of the Town, which was a competition of musical theatre. My father would have been producing and directing shows and that. So there's kind of a history of musical theatre that I always thought I kind of shunned away from. I always thought that has nothing to do with me. And my father used to play in show bands years and years and years ago. And I'm sure some of the other members of King Kong Company might like this, but King Kong Company was a show band, but it was a modern iteration of a show band, is a modern iteration of a show band that, you know, the lights, the visuals and the characters and theatrics of what happens on stage is as important as the music that it's presented as an entity, which isn't that unusual. You know, if you look, Rihanna's halftime show at the Super Bowl is a really good example of that visually stunning performance. You know, that most performances now have a visual element in them. You know, there still are acts that, you know, Ed Sheeran is a really good example. Just a fella with a guitar will go up on stage, but then actually Ed Sheeran will break it down to just a fella with a guitar, but then he will build it back up into this massive stage show with visuals, lights, screens. So King Kong Company is a band.
They're currently in a band. You're just not with them.
I'm just not. I stepped away. I did a couple of festivals last summer. It's a very difficult thing to step away from, is a band that plays big stages at festivals. It's kind of like a drug that you get addicted to. You have to wean yourself off it. So I did two gigs last year, but phased myself out from doing that.
Yeah. As well as that, though, to bring it back to academia.
Yeah.
You're currently a lecturer in music, but you didn't actually originally study music.
No, my undergrad was computer science.
Yeah.
And I studied in the RTC in Galway at the time, But I was all like, I was brought up in a musical family, and we had a pub in Tramore, and there was always music in the pub, and I was playing in bands from a very young age. I can't remember what age. I was playing drums, and when I went to college in Galway, I was playing in bands in Galway, and I was always playing in bands, and I saw computer science as a way to find a job and to have a sideline in playing, as many people who play in bands do. Mm. You know, that I would play in the bands, that would be for enjoyment, that wouldn't be my career, but computer science would be my career. And through working with Spree in Waterford for years, I came back from, I went over to America on the J1 and came back after I finished college, and I had moved back to Waterford. I was at a bit of a loss, and I saw the Spree drummers playing with a band out in the Vic in Tramore, and I said, geez, that looks like great fun, I'll do that. So joined the Spree drummers, became involved in Spree. The lads in Spree, similar to yourself, asked me to do a little bit more and a little bit more over the years, and that kind of culminated in composing, recording and producing the music for the launch of the Cork City of Culture. There's Cork as the City of Culture in 2005, I think it was, their stint. Spree did the opening show. Mm. So I put together the music for that. And that was not the first time, but it was the time where I combined technology and music more than any other time. And it was starting to dawn on me, hang on, music and technology is a thing. And then when I went to research it, I found out, yes, it's very much a thing. It's an active field of study and of employment. And I realised that maybe I could combine computer science and music. And I had been working for a technology company. We were system control and data analysis. Calum Technologies was the name of the company. And it was actually one of the lads from Spree. It was his company. So I got that. Not only did Spree introduce me to my academic role, but I got a job working for a technology company when I came back. And we were programming factory machinery and analysing the data. Like, an example would be we programmed the machine that makes Viennettis. So
right,
this big machine was made down an engineering company in Tipperary, and we just told it when to start, when to stop, when to put the chocolate on the top, when to stop, and count how many units it produced. That's the kind of stuff that we did. So that was interesting, and that was very rewarding work, because with that kind of work, when we finished that job, you could stand back from the thing and it would do the thing you programmed it to do. And that was quite fulfilling at the time. But an opportunity came to take redundancy from that job. And I had started getting more and more into that work I was doing with Spree, started to do the sound design for a couple of plays around Waterford as well, for films. And I took that redundancy at the time, and I went and did an MA in Music and Media Technology in Trinity in Dublin, 2 years full-time masters. And that then just opened up a whole new world to me. I wasn't sure what I'd be able to do employment wise when I finished that, but as I was doing that course, I was in contact with WIT at the time, now SETU, with some of the staff who were teaching music, and in particular Helen Arthur, who was in charge of music technologies, just saying, look, I'm doing this if anything comes up. And not that long after contacting Helen, she like very kindly got back to me, said, I think there's a job coming up, I'm going on a leave of absence. And sure enough, the job came up, it was advertised, and I went for interview. And I think, being a little bit pushy, and if there are any students listening to this who are doing postgrad studies, you know, not so much being pushy, but knocking on the doors, the fact that I had been in contact with the people in advance of finishing my master's, they knew who I was, they knew what I was about, and then I was interviewed by them for that role. So I think that made things a bit easier for me. Maybe not just that they knew me, maybe it put me at ease because I knew them as well. I think that worked to my advantage. So that master's saw me bringing together music and technology in a very real way, and in an academic way. I think the final project I did for my final project for the thesis at the end of that MA was the first broadcast of surround sound audio on the digital radio network. So RTE very kindly let me go in and use their digital DAB was being introduced at the time, ill-fated DAB radio. So I broadcast some of my own compositions, and some of the other students in Trinity, we had surround sound compositions, so we broadcast them on the DAB network in surround sound, and that was the first time that had been done in the country. So that was really interesting.
So you've been working as a lecturer in music technology and music industry in WIT/SETU now for a number of years. Yeah. And at the same time then, you were also
playing music.
Playing music, yeah, with King Kong Company and other projects as well along, yeah, the way. But now, and the reason why you're here today is that you're just at the start of a PhD.
Yeah.
And I love the title of this now, and we're going to unpack this because there's a lot. I think there's a lot in it, right? So my own cards on the table, I've obviously a huge interest in music. I still think of myself as a musician, even though I don't play an awful lot anymore. But that's another day's work. Your title is currently Moving Towards Ethical and Sustainable Music Industry Practice.
Yeah.
Now, that's a lot, right?
It is.
Okay.
So now, before you ask me something,
yes,
can I ask you a couple of things?
Absolutely.
And we're going to come back to one of them in particular, and I think this might help unpack that.
Yes.
I'm going to let you get to it. The first question, and I think this is at the core of a lot of the stuff that I've been doing, because not only have I been teaching music, but I've been dabbling in journalism for the last decade.
Of course you have.
Well.
Yeah. Oh yeah, we didn't get into that, yeah, about all the schemes and, that you did and the, yeah, books that you've written. Yeah.
Kind of music-ish journalism. So 2.5 years writing for the Irish Times and, yeah, a stint on the John Murray Show on RT Radio, which was kind of veering into music. So there's been a bit of writing about it. But at the crux, especially of what I'm researching now and in talking to a lot of music students, there's a question often comes up, and I'd like to ask you this question.
Okay.
And we'll come back to the answer. What is music for, do you think?
That's a brilliant question.
And it's at the crux of a lot of this stuff.
Wow. What is music for?
Yeah, do you think? What is music for?
For me.
It's subjective. It's completely subjective. Yeah.
For some people, music is background.
Yeah.
For others, I hate to say it, but it's the soundtrack to your life.
Mm.
What's the name of the American DJ who says that? What was his name? Music.
Oh,
it's the soundtrack to our lives.
Yeah.
Which is true, I suppose. For me, I just can't imagine a world without music.
Yeah,
I constantly listen to things, always.
So like, what's it for then?
What's it for? For me, it's for enjoyment, but it's also for meaning.
Okay, enjoyment and meaning.
I discover things about myself by listening to music, by playing music.
Yeah.
There's a social element to it as well.
Yeah, so we're going to park that,
yeah,
because I think at the end of the discussion, I'd like to come back to that. But it runs through a lot of the stuff that, yeah, people aren't really talking about, but I think it's crucial to some of it. I just ask you another thing, and I'm going,
yeah,
you can ask me something. Well, I'd ask you to imagine something, right?
Right, go for it.
Imagine your favourite restaurant in, yes, the world. It mightn't exist. It might be something, you know, a kind of a hypothetical restaurant, but it's somewhere you go with loved ones to celebrate important milestones in your life.
Mm.
So it's a restaurant that you associate with really good times, that when you think about these good times, this restaurant has been part of that, you know, that, and it's somewhere you go for enjoyment or as a treat to yourself. Mm. So that's the kind of place this restaurant is, right? You have it, right? Now, after years of that, after that restaurant being part of your life and that important in that way, imagine finding out that the staff in this restaurant are paid a pittance, and actually some of them aren't paid at all. And some of the staff in the restaurant, not only are they not paid, but when they finish working in the restaurant, they actually owe the owner of the restaurant money when they finish there. And then imagine that the owner of the restaurant is a multimillionaire, and is a multimillionaire because of the way that they treat their staff. And not only that, if you can imagine that this restaurant, that the life expectancy of the staff is significantly lower than the general population, and that there's a much more, there's an increased likelihood that staff in this restaurant will commit suicide. Would that tarnish your view of the restaurant?
I know what you're getting at.
You do, but of course I know what you're getting at.
But in the context of a restaurant, yes, of course it would.
Would you think twice before eating there again?
Yes, of course it would, yes.
And what would you say to somebody thinking of starting to work there?
I know what you're saying.
Yeah.
Yes, I know. Don't do it.
Yeah, I'm not just pulling this. And
yes,
we'll get into this
because
I think we're getting into it.
Yeah.
And we can kind of pad that out a bit. University of Sydney did a study about the music industry, and they did a study and crunched the numbers for popular music artists in the US who died between 1950 and 2014. That was a 2014 study.
Yeah.
And they found that the life expectancy of popular musicians was 25 years less than the general population. Like, that's massive. So popular music professionals who are successful on average, were dying 25 years younger than the general population. And their likelihood to commit suicide was 2 to 7 times more. They were 2 to 7 times more likely to commit suicide. Those figures alone are pretty stark. So that's kind of dealing, you know, the other thing then in relation to that example that I was giving you, there's a great documentary, a music documentary called Supermensch, about one of the best, that like the most famous music managers in the world. Yes. Alice Cooper's manager for a long time, Shep Gordon.
I've seen it. Yeah,
it's
fantastic. It's excellent.
But there's a moment in that where he looks into the camera and he talks about taking on a new client. And he says into the camera that when he takes on a new client, he says this to them, and he says, "If I do my job perfectly, I'll kill you." And that's this kind of moment of seriousness in that. And he's not saying that lightly. He started his career in the company of Janis Joplin, Jimi Hendrix.
Yeah.
Jimi Hendrix advised him to become a music manager. Jim Morrison as well. So these people who died at the age of 27, they were his contemporaries. So they were working in the business that he was working in. So he's not saying that lightly. And then the other thing I'm talking about in that, the idea that, you know, it damages people, and we're still kind of using that restaurant. I'm really hammering that restaurant analogy. There's a book out published last year by a music journalist called Ian Winwood, who's written for Rolling Stone, NME, and it's called Bodies: Life and Death in Music. Really, really, really good read. But in it, one of the things he talks about, and he talks about this idea of the damage that a life in music does to people. And one of the quotes from that is that he says there's something systematically broken in the world of music, that it's making people ill. That's what he said, that this is making people ill. And one of the, I thought this was an interesting stat that came out in the height of the pandemic. So we're talking like 2021, when the music industry was shut down. So I think most people, even if they only have a passing interest in music and the entertainment industry, will have heard musicians during that period talking about how their livelihood was decimated. Mm. The CEO of Universal Music, Lucian Grange, in that year, his salary was the subject of MPs in the UK brought it up in the House of Parliament, and it was an article in The Guardian. He earned £150 million sterling that year. That was his salary in 2021. And that was a year when musicians were struggling. So Crispin Hunt was the head of the Ivors Academy at the time. He said it was just obscene. The musicians' union in the UK came out about that as well. And for one person who was the CEO of Universal Music in the UK to have a salary of £150 million at that time, which, if you added together all the earnings of all the songwriters in the UK in 2019, Lucian Grange made more in 2021 than all of them added together.
Okay, but right, so I want to separate. I think we're mixing a couple of different things here.
Go on,
and this is what I want to push back on you.
Yeah, I'm teasing out. That's the end of the restaurant metaphor. So.
But so there's a difference, say, between music and the music industry. And
yes.
Then also what you're describing there is capitalism.
Absolutely.
And I'm not trying to defend anything or take a position on anything, but I suppose that's capitalism. And you could look at that with respect to energy companies at the moment.
Yeah.
Or I'm not saying it's right. Mm. Or certain pharmaceutical companies or certain tech companies. Or you insert any industry here, that there is an imbalance in the way that people are rewarded, probably.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean?
And here's what I want to look at in this PhD. There's an imbalance, you know, and this area of when commerce and arts come together, there's an imbalance. And you mentioned fairness there.
Mm.
Ethics. When does ethics come into this? What's ethical and what isn't ethical? And that's the question that I don't think is being asked. That if you asked anybody on the street, is the music industry fair? Most people would probably say no. You know, I know that.
I'd say if you ask most people, they probably say, I don't know, because they don't care.
Yeah,
as in, well, you care about music, I care about music. One thing I've learned is that most people don't give a fiddler's.
They don't. The convenience, like when we talk about Spotify, you know, that I think, and I ask students these questions all the time and other people, but most people know that artists aren't being paid well from Spotify, but we still use it. But making a distinction between fairness and ethics, especially when you think about that study from the University of Sydney. You know, if people who enter this industry are reducing their life expectancy, if the people who enter this industry are more likely to commit suicide, and where I'm coming from then in this is not only as a musician, I'm teaching music students. So what I'm doing is I'm preparing students to enter this industry. I think it would be negligent of me not to, first of all, make students as aware as possible as I can about this industry, but then also to maybe try and investigate a little bit more why this is happening and maybe try and do something to change it, even if I can do that ever so slightly.
Okay, now I'm not disagreeing with you, and I'm not trying to belittle people's mental health or life expectancy or anything like that. But are there any comparable studies with other industries or other sectors, like, for example, the construction industry or farming, where there are very high degrees, high rates of suicide?
Yeah.
Are there any comparisons between music or the professional music industry and farming or anything like that?
There may be. That's part of what my PhD research is going to look for. I know that there are in business, and that, you know, and in the mining industry, especially when it comes to people who are on offshore oil rigs, that there are studies in relation to this and there are practices in relation to that. But in the music industry, there isn't studies, you know, that whether or not there's a study in farming sector, you know, that there may be, whether there's a study in relation to this in the mining sector or in any other, the fishing industry, there may be, but there isn't in relation to music. There's a study in what the figures are up to 2014, but there's nowhere where this is being addressed in terms of ethics at the moment.
Okay, I want to ask you a big question. You talk about the word ethics there. Describe what you mean by ethics in a general sense.
Well, the best I can come up with is, there's a definition that I've been leaning on, and this is the area where I'm going to be weakest coming into this, because you talked, like, I have a good deal of experience in music and in the music industry and in industry itself. Patterson says that the ethically responsible person is one who rationally assesses courses of behaviour and actions having regard to salient factors and particularly to the needs and interests of other morally significant beings. Now, that's the textbook definition of what an ethical actor is. And for me, I kind of boil that down. You know, somebody who has an interest or somebody who's concerned about the needs and interests of others. That, you know, to distill that down into the thing. And that's where this becomes kind of interesting, where somebody has a moral obligation to the needs and interests of others. And we go back to Shep Gordon. You know, when Shep Gordon says to his clients, if I do my job perfectly, I'll kill you. When you sign a contract, usually with a management company or with a record company in the music industry, and I've gone back over record contracts and managing contracts I've signed myself, there's usually a line in it that says, serve the best interests of the client. That's the usual language there. And this is where this becomes interesting in terms of ethics, that often the best interest of the client is interpreted as the economic best interest of the client. That by booking as many gigs as you can, and this is what Shep Gordon is talking about, from a manager's perspective, if a manager does his job perfectly, he'll book as many gigs as possible for the act, making them as much money, which is in their best financial interest. But it may not be in their best physical and mental health interest. So teasing that out ethically is something that I'm interested in exploring in this. So to answer your question, that's the long-winded way of answering. Yeah. But to answer it in short, according to Patterson, it's, you know, paying particular regard to the needs and interests of other people.
Okay, but again, I'm gonna hit back with you and say, is that not just capitalism? Because the same could be said for a company making widgets that has a destructive or that has a negative effect on the environment. So it's putting stuff into a river, let's just say, right? But the more widgets they make, the more stuff goes into the river. But they're financially rewarded for producing more widgets, so therefore they produce more stuff goes into the river. But that's capitalism. And I'm not saying it's right. And I, like, I feel like but, I'm playing, I'm, are, I'm going
but
with
you
a
are right. It is capitalism. And what you're talking about is business. And there is a field of business ethics. When business students go and study business, they study business ethics. And that's what you're talking about. You're talking about capitalism and business. But when music students study music, they don't study music ethics. There is not a field of music ethics. Okay. And when you go and do an MA in music management, there aren't ethics courses on that. So the field of business ethics that deals with exactly what you're talking about about, like, a friend of mine studied engineering. They had an ethics module on the engineering course. They have ethics module. They have an ethics school. I'm starting a module, actually a cert in Cornell University on business ethics. There's four modules on business ethics. Mm. That field exists. The people involved in that world had a, have a code of practice. Whether they follow it or not is another thing. In the world of music industry and the entertainment industry, there is not that code of practice. There is not that field of education. There's not that field of publication. So the world you're talking about has an ethics study. There is business ethics. It exists as a field. But the field of music industry ethics or entertainment industry ethics, is it doesn't exist at the moment.
Might that be because music is often viewed as a pastime rather than a job?
Quite possibly. And that's something that I'd like to look into as well. It's something I worry about. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Because I often hear things, are you still at the music? Are you still, blah, blah, blah. You know, when are you going to get a real job?
Yeah. I think that changed slightly over the course of the pandemic. But I think that's, I think it's endemic in most societies, particularly in Irish society, where something that worried me a bit is not just how music is viewed. Music is worth 1.6 billion euros to the exchequer every year, according to IMRO. So it earns a massive amount of money. Lucian Grange, the CEO of Universal Music, his salary is £150 million in 2021. So there is a lot of money. It's a job to him. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a very serious job to him. But you're right. In some areas, it's not regarded as a job.
I'm not suggesting that.
Yeah, I know, but it is. Yeah, yeah. And I think in government, it's not regarded as a serious job. There have been quotes from members of government pretty much saying that. One thing I was worried about, and I think it's starting to change now, is an organisation like Music Generation, where if you work for Music Generation, and this is an organisation that's primary concern is music.
It's music education.
Yeah, but they're in the world of music. They're funded by U2. If you're an administrator for Music Generation, you get a contract, you get everything that goes with a contract and employment. But if you're a music teacher and a musician who works for Music Generation, you don't get treated the same. You don't get the same kind of contract. Now, they're starting to change that. But that, to me, suggests exactly what you're talking about. I think it's starting to change. And where I see this starting to change is in the UK in particular. Tom Gray from the band Gomez started a campaign called #BrokenRecord. Back in 2018, I think he started the campaign. It started to grow legs in 2020. And what Tom Gray has told me in an interview that I've done with him is that he started that Broken Record campaign to address the unfairness of streaming. And what he's looking to do, it's not just about streaming. For Tom Gray, it's about establishing a middle class for musicians. That you have these musicians who don't get paid a lot at all, and then you have musicians who get paid so much money, it's unbelievable. But there's very little middle ground there. And what Tom Gray is hoping to do is to change how music is regarded. And one of the things, one of the successful outcomes of that campaign was that they had an inquiry by UK government in the House of Parliament, where MPs sat down and interviewed the heads of streaming services, the heads of record companies, to find out the economic impact of streaming services. And what they found, it was incredibly interesting. They found that it was unfair that, you know, you had this body of politicians who for the first time said, hang on, we need to look at this. Mm. And they came out and said it was unfair. And that idea of fairness, I think, is important. You know, we're talking about that fairness. But they also said that not only was it unfair, but it needed further investigation. So for an official body like the UK government to come out and say, we need to change the economics and the laws around what's happening in the music industry, that was a massive moment, I think, and a massive shift in how music is regarded. It's not just a pastime anymore. That government inquiry recognised the huge amounts of money that were being generated by streaming and the discrepancy in how that money is being divvied out.
So the provisional title of your PhD, Moving Towards Ethical and Sustainable Music Industry Practice. So we've kind of focused on the ethical element. Mm. Let's focus on the sustainable element for a moment. So when you're talking about sustainability here, I'm assuming you're talking about sustainability of careers rather than environmental sustainability. Or maybe not.
I'm talking about mental health as well.
Okay.
You know, that what's sustainable for somebody as as a person who works in this industry, and it's kind of going back to my interest in this, that
okay,
4 years ago I started a podcast to supplement what I was teaching. I was teaching a module called Professional Development for Musicians, which deals with how the industry is set up and explain, you know, what does a music manager do, what's a publishing deal, to explain that, how that stuff works.
So it's the Irish Music Industry Podcast.
Yeah. And that was to supplement that module, because I knew that over 12 weeks I couldn't get into everything that I needed to get into over 12 weeks. And what I started to do was interview professionals from the Irish music industry and just ask them, what do you do? You know, how does that work? And I was surprised at the legs that that got, that it wasn't just my students. The first thing was graduates who had studied music here started to get in touch with me. Then other musicians from around the country started to get in touch with me. Then lecturers from other universities and other colleges said it's on their course. So it started to gather momentum. And 4 years ago, my idea with that was, I just wanted to say, this is how the music industry works. That was the idea for that. But after having done that for 4 years, I kind of changed my tone on that. And there was a question mark at the end. I go, this is how the music industry works.
Okay.
That 4 year path.
Yeah.
You know, some of the stuff that we started to talk about, that I was flabbergasted with some of the things that people told me. And even more flabbergasted with what they'd tell me after I turned off the microphone about things that they didn't want to talk about in relation to their careers and what they... Because Ireland is really small, and a lot of the stuff that goes on behind the scenes, people aren't going to give out about it because it will have an impact on their employment. You know, if they start to give out about the Olympia in Dublin taking 20% of their merch sales. So that's a common practice now across most large entertainment companies, that if a band is playing in a venue, the venue will, not smaller venues, large venues that usually run by Live Nation or MCD, that they'll take 20% of merch. And that's 20% of sales, not of profits. And on some items of merch, there isn't even a 20% markup. So you're getting some artists who are selling their vinyl in the Olympia when they're playing a gig in the Olympia, and they're losing money when they sell that vinyl in the Olympia. Now, they're not going to complain, because if they complain, they won't get another gig in the Olympia. And Live Nation / MCD, who own the Olympia, run Electric Picnic. They're involved with C Sessions, Independence, lots of festivals around the country. So not only will they not get a gig in the Olympia, they're worried they may not get a gig in other venues as well. So when it comes then to a sustainable career, are there things that we can address that might help musicians make a career for themselves that's not only financially rewarding and is creatively fulfilling, but isn't going to do them damage in the long run? That, you know, they're not going to come out of it and feel like they've been through the mill, or they're not going to have to come out of it because it's actually damaging them, you know, maybe in terms of how much money they're earning, but I think as importantly in what it's doing to their well-being and their sense of well-being. And again, I'll kind of go back to Tom Gray and the Broken Record campaign. One of the things that Tom Gray talks about is that at the height of Gomez's career, they were playing 240 gigs a year. So they were on the road, they were living in a bus, and he talks about how disorientating that was. And especially when they were in America, they would have a doctor on the road with them. And this doctor's purpose was to write them prescriptions for uppers or downers, whatever they felt they needed that day to get them to the gig, to do the gig. This doctor was hired by their management to give them prescriptions. And Tom Gray talks about that very honestly, and that he was addicted to prescription drugs for a period of time that were given to him free by what they were called were rock docs, who would be on the road with bands. And then you see a story like Taylor Hawkins, probably quite recently from Foo Fighters, the drummer from Foo Fighters.
Yeah.
And another tragic story. And I didn't believe those statistics from the University of Sydney. I was saying 25 years seems like a lot. But now every time I hear of something like Taylor Hawkins, I'm kind of going, all right, there's another one. And I'm kind of adding to this list in my head as it goes along. But, you know, in the toxicology report after Taylor Hawkins' death, he had the types of drugs that Tom Gray was talking about being prescribed on the road. And he was on tour at the time. Mm-hmm. And not only was he on tour, but in an article after his death in Rolling Stones, a lot of his friends, Matt Cameron being one of them, the drummer from Pearl Jam, talked about him saying that he couldn't take it anymore, that he had approached his management team and asked them to reduce the number of dates they were playing. And if anything, the number of dates they were playing increased after that. Mm. So, you know, when I talk about sustainability, what I'm looking at is, are there things that can be addressed that don't damage people who choose this as a career path and damage them irreparably and in some cases, you know, fatally?
Okay, so if I wanted to be flippant,
yeah.
Okay, now, and I'm playing devil's advocate here, okay, because I agree largely with what you're saying, okay, but just to kind of push
largely
back on it.
Yeah, go on.
No, no, I do, I do, yeah, yeah. I do. Yeah. I don't have the data to back it up, yeah. but anecdotally, you chimes with a lot of what I've heard
yeah.
elsewhere and my own experiences, which wouldn't be anywhere near as extensive as yours. But the if I was to be flippant, I could say, but you're, isn't sex, drugs and rock and roll part of the appeal?
Yeah. Yeah. For some, it is. I don't think
but
it
it's
is.
It's not sustainable.
That's not sustainable.
Yeah.
But I don't think it is for professional musicians. I don't think that's the appeal. If you have a band that want to bring what they do to the highest level possible, they won't get there in the first place. If they're doing the sex, drugs and rock and roll thing, the work ethic that's required by some of the acts, like let's take Rihanna or you yeah. know, those the big, when you're talking about the multinational acts, they're so disciplined in what they do. You know, the discipline required to do what they do day in, day out. If that was the appeal, it quickly wears off. I think that might have been the appeal in the 60s and the 70s, like Ozzy Osbourne is still somehow alive, you know, the
Keith
Rolling
Richards,
Stones.
Yeah, yeah.
yeah but
yeah.
They court that is very much an image that's courted by some acts, but isn't actually lived on. Like I've seen it. Like I've seen yeah. bands pretend to do things on stage or pretend to be a character, but when they leave the stage, they're very different people.
Mm.
You know, Chris Martin from Coldplay, he's not about the sex and drugs and rock and roll. And I think one of the things that's, I think there's a movement at the moment, and I think the Broken Record campaign by Tom Grey is part of that movement. And I think at the core of that movement is the moving away from the sex, drugs and rock and roll thing, where you see bands now talking about yoga
yeah.
and vegetarianism and the health. Tanya O'Callaghan, the bass player from Ireland, who's on the road now at the moment with Whitesnake. Tanya is a fantastic bass player. Moved to the States. She's playing with some of the best rock bands in the world. I think she was on the road with Twisted Sister before that. Tanya's doing great. Tanya has an Instagram channel about veganism. And Tanya wouldn't be performing at the level that she's performing at if it was going out every night on the lash, you know, and doing that. Now, but here's the thing about that, right? That where that became kind of the marketable, and I think this might be maybe at the core of that. That's not a new thing. This kind of idea of the kind of, it's almost the necromancy thing, you know, that image of the bad boy or the bad girl, that sold. And it was realized quite quickly that that was a successful marketing tool. Back to Robert Johnson. You know, Robert Johnson,
the blues
was
guitar
reputedly
player, yeah,
did
yeah,
a deal
yeah.
with the devil. You can actually go back to Paganini, the violinist, who as well reputedly did a deal with the devil. And Robert Johnson was tied up into this thing of playing in juke joints. People noticed that that worked, that kind of folklore around music did have a positive impact on the legend, or if you were to be very commercial about it, the brand, you know, that did work on the brand. But the impact that had on some people, when you look at some of the people who lived by that or believed the sex, drugs and rock and roll lifestyle image that they were sold, that it did them irreparable damage. And I remember I was interviewing Jerry Fish about this, and Jerry Fish was signed to Atlantic Records when he was playing with Emotional Fish. They toured in the States. Amit Ertegun, who worked with Ray Charles, head of Atlantic Records, who signed Led Zeppelin, he signed an Emotional Fish and he worked with them in the studio. So Jerry Fish had like this insight into the recording music industry at the highest possible level. And he said he noticed very quickly that the image that he was sold of bands isn't what they were. Like this image of working class, make good, you know, these bands that kind of started from very humble beginnings and they go on to superstardom. He said that he didn't believe that at all by the time he finished in the music industry, that a lot of the people who rose to the highest level and who were working and earning money from it were very savvy, very well-educated people who weren't buying into sex, drugs and rock and roll.
Yes. I'm not going to disagree with anything that you've said there at all, because my experience in the music industry is anyone who's been around for a period of time has a good head on their shoulders, and the idea of spending 7 nights a week on the lash, it isn't sustainable.
No. And the other thing is that
And also people venues work hard. They won't work with you. Yeah.
Venues and managers and booking agents, they won't. I always think of the Pogues, and I read the story about their manager going to see them and Shane McGowan falling off the stage and him saying, oh yeah, these guys are going to make it big. And they did, but I've heard some horrible, awful stories about how Shane McGowan's alcoholism was not just facilitated, but it became part of what they were sold. Like, that's what sold the Pogues. I don't know how that man is still alive. I really don't. But did it do him any good? I don't know. He'd be a good fella to talk to about it. That's my point. That they're not going to work with you if that's the attitude that you have. The professional organisations probably aren't going to take you on. There are exceptions to that.
Okay, let me come at this from a different, because I'm coming across like Johnny Business here, and I know nothing about business, right? So I'm just kind of trying to, I suppose, maybe challenge what you're saying. But I'm going to come at it from a different angle now. And this might help to perhaps explain where a lot of these conflicts come into it. Is that, okay, music is an art. And it's a creative process. For many people, it's a creative process. For some people, it's not. But okay, let's just assume that it's a creative process. And that's irrespective of genre. Like, you've largely focused on kind of rock and dance and those kind of things.
Yeah, it's popular music I'm dealing with.
But I mean, it could be classical music as well, or whatever, right? Okay. There's some famous Hellraisers in classical music or what have you yourself, right? But it's a creative process, it's an art. And with the creative process comes emotion. There's always going to be some element of emotion or vulnerability in that. And when you try to collide that with business and capitalism, is that maybe where the conflict is coming in? Because you have a vulnerability hitting up against profit.
Yeah.
Could that be the problem?
Yeah, I'd just roll back a little bit and say it's not always where people are coming from. Some artists, and I'm going to go back a step because now I think it would be a good time. When I asked you what music was for, you said it was for enjoyment and meaning, right? Mm. And I've asked people this. I've been working in SETU since 2008, and I've been asking students this since 2008, and none of them ever say it's for money. Not one over... Oh no, sorry, there was one. And now he's working in commercial radio. There was one student.
And this, if he's working in commercial radio, he's not making any money either.
Well, but one student, and recently I was at a Growth Hub event. We were at a seminar up in Dublin.
Yeah.
And it was about entrepreneurship. And I was delivering a talk about some funding I got from Growth Hub in relation to music students and gigs we put on. Mm. But I asked that room that was mainly business school lecturers and business school staff, what they thought music was for. None of them said money. And they are coming from a business angle. Mm. So what you have is you have this thing where when you ask most people about this, they say music is for communication, enjoyment, pleasure, lots of different answers, very rarely money. And that's not why people usually start music. So this is where, and you're right, this is where you come up against what I call friction when it comes to commerce, that there is a lot of money to be made for it. But the vast majority of people don't enter into it for that reason. And for that reason, I go back to Ian Winwood in his book. He says that, all the musicians he's talked to over the years, all of them, bar a couple, are what he would call financially illiterate. And some of them on purpose, because sometimes when music is commercially successful, in some instances, the fans of the music then will back away from it. That some of them don't want their music to be commercially successful. So there is this very uncomfortable space between commerce and music in particular, but art in general. Mm. And that's the space that I want to investigate. And, a lot of what I have at the moment are just questions that I don't know the answers to, but the evidence seems to point that that's the area where you get a lot of this discomfort. And it's the area when... Go back to Shep Gordon. When Shep Gordon says, if I do my job perfectly, I'll kill you. And what he means about that, have you touring so much that it's going to do you serious damage. That managers can see that's how you make as much money as you can from an artist. Have them on the road as long as you possibly can, because that's where most money is. The money from recorded music, it's not as lucrative as it once was. That there's a lot more money to be made by keeping people out on the road. So that's the friction. Artists don't want to be on the road that much. Artists want to be playing music and creating music. They don't want to be playing the same thing night after night, living on a bus. So that is where there is some friction. And then when you consider that ethically then, you know, and that idea of acting in the best interests of an individual, not just financially, but in terms of their well-being. If you keep somebody like Tom Gray and Gomez on the road for 240 nights out of the year to the extent where they need to self-medicate, is that ethical? You know, that's how they make as much money as they possibly can. Not a large percentage of it going to Tom Gray, a large proportion of it going to the manager who's booking the gigs as well, getting at least 20% of that. Then, you know, you see the management of Foo Fighters and the questions that might be around their decisions to keep Taylor Hawkins on the road for as long as they did, to the extent where he needed to self-medicate. That, yes, is the answer to your question. You know, there is a lot of friction between that world of commerce and that world of art or music or creativity. And I think there always has been. One of the examples I think of, and it goes back to this idea of financial control is artistic control. You know, if you're in charge of your finances, you're in charge of what you do artistically. And you can go back to Michelangelo painting the ceiling in the Sistine Chapel. You know, he didn't pay for the paint. He was being paid to do that. And the person who was paying him to do that was the Pope. And legend has it that the devil in the scene on the ceiling on the Sistine Chapel has the face of that Pope, that he wasn't happy about everything he was being asked to put on that ceiling. He didn't get to choose everything he did. So that question and that friction goes back quite a long way when it comes to the arts. But what I'm interested in talking about is, you know, where does that relationship cross the line from being unfair into being unethical? Mm. And that's something that I'm going to spend the next 5 years trying to figure out. And I don't know if I'll figure it out or not, but I think I have been, like, as I said to you, that podcast and what I've done in playing music. Like, I know from playing in the band, there was times where we were told stuff playing in the band and we went, what? And I said, oh yeah, that's the way it works. And I'm kind of going, that can't be the way it works.
I remember you wrote an article, or I remember reading an article about King Kong Company. I can't remember if you wrote it or you were just interviewed for it.
I wrote it, yeah.
This is the one from
the Irish Independent.
The Irish Independent one about we made 100 grand last year and we didn't get paid a penny.
Yeah.
Or something like that.
We lost money. And on foot of that, we sold out the Olympia in Dublin. Sold it out. You know, that's over 1,000 people. Yeah. And we lost 5 grand. You know, and we knew going into that now. Part of that is how the music industry is set up. I remember at the time there was an agent from the UK came over to see us, and we knew he was coming over and we were putting on the best show we possibly could. So we knew in advance what we were going to clear from that gig because we'd sold it out in advance. But then we also saw our costs and we didn't hold back on spending money. And there's a couple of questions around this, but I remember that agent from the UK who went on to get us gigs at Glastonbury and big festivals in the UK. He did his job. Mm. He came to Dublin. We impressed him. That was our job. But it cost us money to impress him. But that's what we were trying to do. So we lost 5 grand on that gig.
Okay. My capitalism hat on, and I could say, well, you chose
made that
to
choice.
Do that.
Yeah, yeah. But also, we could have made money if we weren't being charged 20% of our merch. Or we could have made more money if the venue wasn't charging us as much, if there weren't, like, we can go through the costs on that, and some of them are quite surprising. Yeah, we made the choice, but the dice were loaded in that choice. But we went to the table knowing that the dice were loaded.
Yeah.
But that agent said to me, lovely guy, who actually left the music industry during COVID because I think he was done with it, but really nice guy. And he laughed and he said, that show cost you a lot of money. This was after the gig, we're having a pint. And I went, yeah, it did. Yeah. And he was laughing and he said, you know, you're not allowed to make money in this industry, don't you? And he was saying that like jokingly, but not jokingly.
Yeah, yeah,
and,
yeah.
You know, and in retrospect, you know, he was kind of right. So, yes, that informed that. And looking at a turnover of in the region of 100 grand and kind of going, where does that money go? And that's what I told you about. Like that informed the podcast. But that led me to this place of, OK, hang on a minute. Is this really how it has to operate? That's how it does operate at the moment. But is that how it has to operate? Like, and Like our band, we did okay in Ireland, you know, and the King Kong Company are still doing okay in Ireland, kind of mid-range, selling out venues like the Olympia, big gigs at festivals. But when you look at bigger acts, like there was an interesting video I saw of TLC, who were receiving 4 Grammys.
Hmm.
And as they were receiving the 4 Grammys, they were saying, we're not getting paid. And then there's a video of S Club 7, kind of famous one, when they announced their last tour. And they, you know, the interviewer said, I hear your manager.
This is not the new tour. This is
no,
going
this
around.
No, this is the original one.
15 years ago.
15 years ago.
Or more even, probably.
The interviewer asked him a question. I hear your manager made 9 million from what you do, but you're not making anything. And that interview got shut down by their PR person, live on television, shut it down. So this, it's not a new story, you know, that the dice are loaded. But the story that I want to try and, or the question that I want to address is, do the dice always have to be loaded? And from initial research, like we're talking about some of the horror stories, and I think we focused mainly on the unethical stuff, but there is the ethical stuff as well. Like what Tom Gray is doing, you know, that inquiry into the economics of streaming, that, you know, there's an artist called Imogen Heap who has this collective called Mycelium. That's, you know, there are these other ways of doing this. You know, we know what Spotify is doing is quite unfair when it comes to remuneration of artists. That's where Lucian Grange is getting a lot of that 150 million from. It's not, Spotify take a lot of the flack, but the record companies own a lot of Spotify. And that, like, there's some statistics from Goldman Sachs where they're saying that the music industry is going to earn more than it ever earned before. And it's the record companies who are taking that cut from Spotify. But there's an Irish streaming company called Minim who operate a whole different method of paying artists. It's called the user-centric way of paying artists. So there are a lot of these little pockets of ethical practice that can be adopted. And one of the things that I thought was really interesting when I started talking about this to other musicians online, you know, in a forum that I'm on about the music industry, one musician said to me, but if we don't use Spotify, we're not really in the race, you know, that we have to use Spotify, that Spotify is music. And that's the way they word it, you know, without Spotify, there is no music. And I thought that was really interesting because this was a musician. And I was kind of thinking about that. Without Spotify, there's no music. And when you think about this, you know, the music industry hasn't existed for a long time. And I think that one of the greatest tricks the music industry ever played was convincing people that it makes music exist when it doesn't. The music industry doesn't make music exist. Musicians, composers, producers make music exist. And the music industry has only been around for a relatively short period of time. Let's say the 1700s, the advent of the printing press is when music became industrialized, when you could mass produce a music
sheet
product.
But that was sheet music.
Sheet music, exactly. Which was the original, you know, when a song went to number one in the 1800s, it was on sheet music. So that's when it was industrialized. Then the phonograph industrialized the recording of music. But you go back to a discovery in a cave in Germany, you know, they found bone flutes that are 40,000 years old. So we have evidence that music has been around for at least 40,000 years. I think we can say that it was around before these bone flutes. But for at least 40,000 years, people have been playing music. And only in the last 300 years or so, that has been industrialized. So that friction that we have is from a relatively new addition to the world of music. And when we talk about what music is for, we're still very in tune with that. Mm-hmm. We're still very in tune with what it means to us and what it means to different people. And trying to find a way to build a bridge between the people who create music and want to make a living from doing that and the people who are making a hell of a lot of money from it. It's not that, you know, when you very rightly say that maybe music isn't regarded as a job, you know, there are a lot of people who are making a lot of money from it. But if we create
I'm not suggesting that. I'm just echoing what other people
have said. It is something that is suggested. But if we build a bridge, you know, an ethical bridge between those creators and producers and where those vast amount of money are being made, you know, that, or even if we just ask questions about building a bridge between that, building a bridge that's ethical, that's built in an ethical way, not like a World Cup stadium, you know.
I'm conscious of time, right?
Yeah.
But I just want to just pull on one last thread before we finish up, just a bit sustainability. Yeah. And you mentioned the kind of the lack of a musical middle class.
Yeah.
Now, I remember talking with numerous journalists and various music people from down throughout the years. And I remember Stuart Clark from Hot Press magazine. Anyone who's half aware of music in Ireland would have heard him on the radio or read his pieces or whatever. And he told me about, like, in the 80s and even up to the 90s, you had there was a musical middle class. There was that middle tier artist or band who wasn't making huge money but was making the average industrial wage from selling a few records, playing gigs, and it was manageable.
Mm.
And in the 2000s, that was completely hollowed out.
Mm.
Is what you're suggesting that is there... You're looking to maybe discover the reasons why that was the case,
mm.
and if there's a framework that could be put back in place to allow that to happen. Is that what you're kind of getting at?
Kind of.
Or am I being reductive?
No, part of it is, yeah. Well, part of it is finding out why that happened and then asking the question, is it ethical? You know, and is there an ethical alternative? Like, one of the reasons that happened in that period in particular is the advent of the 360 record deal. That and can I just kind of flag this kind of like an asterisk on everything we're saying?
Yeah.
We're talking about original music, you know, the creation, performance and sale of original music, where I know lots of people who are making a good living out of music, but they're playing in bands that might be doing functions.
Weddings,
they're playing
in
bands, yeah. They're playing in pubs. Some of them are making commercial music for ads, you know, what's called production and library music, that there are people making a good living from that, you know. And actually there are people making a good living creating original music. I can think of some of our graduates who that's their job. They create music for ads, for film, for television, and there is quite a lucrative career to be made from that. So, you know, there are people who are making money from music and who are doing it in, like, who are self-employed and who are doing it in an ethical fashion, you know, and that's something to investigate as well. But it's when it's the creation of original music and crossing over into this field of original recorded music, management deals and booking agents that, as you mentioned, this area of business and the commerce around the music industry coming up against the music business. That's where there's difficulty. So, sorry, that was just to flag that. But going back to your question there about in the 2000s, one of the things that contributed to that was the advent of the 360 record deal, where...
Could you explain what that is? Yeah.
Record companies saw that artists didn't need to rely on recorded music as much anymore because it was more lucrative for them to go on the road. So back in the 50s and the 60s, what used to happen was a band would tour to promote their album. They'd bring out this piece of recorded music and they'd make so much money from the recorded music, it'd pay for the tour and they'd make a profit for it. Whereas that model changed as you went into the, let's say, the 80s up to the 2000s, where the record companies saw that there was a lot of money being made from these recordings. So they changed their model of operation.
Sorry, there was more money being made from the tours than the recordings.
No, at that point, there was more money being made from the recordings. So yes. 50s into the 60s. Record companies saw this and they said, well, we'll take a bigger slice of the money being made from the recordings. So they changed their business model to a model where Tom Gray again talks really well about this, where an artist would get an advance, which was pretty much a loan.
Yeah.
And then the record company would recoup 80% of the profits from that recording, but only after those profits had paid off the artist's debt. And in most cases, that debt never got paid off. So the record companies owned the recordings and made the largest bulk and slice of that. So then artists weren't making money from recordings, so they turned to touring. And touring became more lucrative than the recordings. So the model changed into the 80s, where a band would make more money from touring. And record companies went, hang on a minute, there's a lot of money to be made in touring. So when we went into the 2000s, record company changed their business model again. And it was the advent of this thing called the 360 record deal. So if I was somebody working for a record company, I'd sign an act to a deal which was the same as the record deal that existed for the last 20 years. But added to this was, we would also now get a percentage of your live touring sales.
Mm.
We would get a percentage of your merch sales. We would get a percentage of any ads that you were in, and we'd get a percentage of any voiceover work you did. So everything that was an income stream for you as an artist, as a record company, we would now get a percentage of that. And one of the first acts to be signed to one of those big deals was Jay-Z by Live Nation. So Live Nation, It's interesting because, again, you're getting into ethics. Live Nation have been investigated by the competition authorities in every country they've been in. MCD in Ireland sold that company to Live Nation, but the owner of MCD, Dennis Desmond, is also an owner of Live Nation. So there's all these machinations there. But Live Nation own the biggest venues in the world. Live Nation own Ticketmaster. Master, yeah. They sell the tickets. Live Nation also own the record companies. So this, like, the competition authority aren't looking into them for no reason. So when Live Nation sign an artist now like Jay-Z, or U2, Live Nation are, yeah, you know, they manage and promote U2. So they get a percentage of every income stream from that artist. So when you see that being hollowed out, like Stuart Clark is talking about, it's because the record companies started to take a cut of everything. And the implications of that, and this is going back to Shep Gordon again, it all kind of feeds into itself. If a band is making less money because a larger proportion of it is going to the record company, there's only one thing they can do to try and make more money, and that's do more gigs. Add on more gigs, tour more. So as their return starts to diminish, they're forced to do more gigs. And we've kind of reached a really critical point at the moment, just this year, in relation to that, you know, artists have always been teetering on the edge. Even the most successful artists teetering on the edge of being able to make a living from what's happening because of these ever diminishing returns. But add into that now an energy crisis, and add into that the spiraling cost of living, and artists can't afford to tour anymore. That they actually can't afford to go on the road. And this are like I mentioned to you, we sold out the Olympia. We lost $5,000. An artist can't come from America and not earn enough money to pay for the tour and to pay themselves. So what you're seeing are bands like Animal Collective from the UK or from the US, who are a successful band, said, we can't afford to tour. We can't go to the UK and Europe this year. Santi Gold is a very well-known popular music artist as well, also came out and said, I can't afford to go on the road this year. The numbers just aren't adding up. So, you know, we have these ever-diminishing returns, but when you add in an energy crisis and spiraling costs in relation to things, and the fact that people can't afford to go to all the gigs. After the shutdown, there were so many gigs programmed for the last 2 years that people don't have the money to go to all those gigs. So that, you know, it's kind of like a perfect storm. So we're really seeing an impact on that now. And Santi Gold in particular talked about the impact that was having on our mental health. So all of this economic stuff, as much as artists don't want to pay attention to it, sometimes it has a massive impact on them. And that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to figure out, is there a better way that we can navigate that area of turmoil between commerce and art? Is there? I don't know if there is or not, but I have a feeling there might be. And that's what I'm looking for.
I'm fascinated with this. And I can't wait to pick your... We've gone way over time, clearly, because we're both kind of into this. And you can tell, certainly from yourself, that there's a huge amount of passion.
Yeah.
You have a huge amount of enthusiasm for the subject.
Yeah, but there has to be, because, I mean, I'm teaching students to go into this world.
Yeah.
And I don't want to be sending them into something where I think there might be damage done to them. I don't think ethically that's something I should do as a lecturer. Maybe, you know, just not even just flag it for them, but this is what's happening there. This is what you have to be prepared for. But maybe I don't have alternatives to offer them at the moment. And I'd love to have alternatives to say, this is how that works, but maybe you could try doing it this way because this mightn't be as risky as that way. And at the moment, I'm not equipped with that. And I think that's a failing on my part as a teacher, as an educator, if I'm sending young people out into an industry that could be potentially damaging to them, and I don't equip them with ways to deal with that, I'm failing, and I don't want to do that anymore.
But what you're saying as well is, in a larger context, is that this isn't an area that has been researched.
No.
Widely.
No.
You know, I mean, there's lots of anecdotal stuff.
Lots of anecdotal
stuff. There's nothing... There's not a huge amount of academic study with numbers and figures and a rigid methodology and blah, 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 blah.
There's some, you know, but there's not a lot.
Yeah.
And think about how often, like, music is taught all around the world in third level institutions all over the world. I found one that's teaching ethics, and it's teaching business ethics. And it's an it's an optional module. So you're even teaching ethics is optional. You know, that's part of what you're teaching there. Yeah. It's so under researched, published, and discussed. And even if all I achieve is starting a discussion around this, I think I'll have done something that will maybe make me feel a little bit better about the job that I'm doing.
Mark, I have one last question for you. If somebody was thinking about getting into research,
yeah,
what advice would you have for them?
I think it has to be something that you can sustain an interest in. You know, the amount of time that it's going to take, and to be aware, and I'm very much aware of this, that nobody might end up reading it, you know. So it has to be your enthusiasm and your interest in it that's going to carry you over the line. If you're going to dedicate a significant portion of your life to going down a very deep and large rabbit hole, you know, for years and years, and something that will have an impact on your quality of life and time you spend on things that you really enjoy doing, it has to be something that you're going to be able to be engaged in for a long period of time. I think I could be wrong in that. You know, maybe some people are able to do it and just have their eyes on, you know, if I do this research, then I'll be able to do X when I'm finished it. Maybe that will sustain people. I don't think that would sustain me, you know, personally speaking. I know after a long period of time of having a different PhD application on my desk that this one is, it seems like everything I've done up to now professionally, both academically and artistically, has led me to this thing. And that's, I'm kind of enthused and engaged in that. And I think that's, for me, that's an important thing.
If somebody wanted to find out more about you and the work that you do,
yeah,
and maybe even follow some of the progress that you might make along the way, where is the best place for them to look?
I'd say start off on the Irish Music Industry Podcast, because...
But you're finished that now, though,
aren't you? But all those, there's four years of episodes up there, which for me is kind of like a, it's like a master class of guest lecturers from Tom Gray, who I mentioned, to... You know, so many different people, not just from Ireland, but from around the world as well. Start there, because I think in that you'll hear, you know, the penny drops over a 4-year period going, is that what music industry is really about? And that's a good place, I think, to get an insight into how it does work. And maybe some of the questions that I started to ask around it that led me to this. Other than that, Instagram, Twitter, at IRMuzzPod. But I'm probably going to have to change that handle in the near future because that podcast has finished. But that's what it is for now. Yeah.
Twitter. But if you do Instagram. A search for Mark Graham on the SETU website, you'll find your profile.
Mark.graham@setu.ie.
Mark, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk with you. And we could talk for another 2 hours, and we probably will. But but we won't record it. We can put it on the unedited podcast.
Yeah.
Listen, thanks so much for coming in. I really do appreciate it.
My pleasure, Rob. Thanks for having me.
And I look forward to following your research.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode. Keep up to date by following us on Twitter at 9plusPodcast, or you can search for us on the setu.ie website. Thanks.